Hello and welcome to All About Symbian Insight number 33 with me, Rafe Blanford.
And myself, Ewan Spence.
And it's just us two today, so we're going to get straight into it with some of the news that's been happening in the last few weeks. Thought we'd start with Engage, Ewan, and I know you've been playing in Brothers in Arms, which you reviewed on All About Engage, but I just wanted to get you to give us some opinions on that game.
Well, Brothers in Arms is a first-person, no, it's a third-person shooter. I've got to get this right, because your camera is behind the soldier you're controlling. The idea behind the game is that you're a World War II soldier. It's just after the D-Day landing, so you're going through northern France, and then you go through the sort of Ardennes and the Battle of the Bulge, and then onto Berlin, and then there's a desert section as well. So basically, it's a run-around-and-shoot-things-for-fun-and-pleasure game. There's been a lot of these, pretty much since Wolfenstein and Doom came up on the PC about 11 or 12 years ago. These have been sort of the mainstays of graphical, powerful gaming. And it's an area that every handheld platform has had problems trying to accommodate with, because you need a lot of graphical power, you need good controls. I mean, there's still not really a good one for the Nintendo NDS. A lot of people try to use one. But you know, have a look at X versus Server and you realize how bad it can be. The PSP, I'm going to bring up the PSP here because it also has Brothers in Arms as part of the franchise on here. And the PSP is a much bigger screen, bigger processor. It's even more powerful than the Engage processor, and it's got, you know, an analog stick, directional stick, your four buttons, your shoulder things. Whereas the Engage, the Engage version on running on the N series, really only has the direction pad and the sort of action buttons as well. So it's a much smaller control set. It's much smaller graphically. There's no 3D chipset in here, so everything's got to be done in software. And that means that the game is a little bit more, it's more cartoony than a realistic first-person shooter here. It handles pretty well. The graphics look good. I have the usual thing that I don't like gameplay where, oh, you're on a big 3D map, but you only have one way that you can go. You know, war is not like that. But war games in these things are. It's really nice diversion. It shows off the Engage incredibly well. But again, it also shows the limitations of the Engage. 320/240 screen just really doesn't have enough definition. I suspect that in 2 years' time, maybe when we have Engage start running in VGA screens at a minimum, and possibly with 3D graphics chip acceleration inside the handset, we will get a really good graphical first-person shooter. At the moment, it's about the quality of Doom, and that's where I would place it. We have something that is the speed of Doom, the movement and the graphics, that sort of game. We don't have something as detailed as Halo or, you know, whatever the latest bandwagon is.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say that, you know, given the limitations of mobile and Engage that we've talked about before, it doesn't do too badly then?
I think this is as best as you're going to get. Now, that's not true. I think in 12 months' time, which the programmers have got a hand of it, we'll have a first-person shooter that's actually slightly better. But given the hardware and the available stuff, I think this is, you know, in the region of what we can get. And it's telling that that's very similar to Ashen, which came out on the original Engage in Series 60 version 1 when it was still called Series 60. You know, we've not seen an improvement in the graphics beyond that, you know, they're still the same, slightly smaller screen, but the quality's still the same, the speed's still the same, the movements are about the same. There's no sea change here. There's nothing that fundamentally changes what can be delivered. We've got the best deliverable possible, I feel.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one, that, because it does rather speak to the future of the platform and, you know, whether they need to deliver these rich kind of games. We won't get into that here. The only other thing I wanted to touch on with Brothers in Arms was the pricing. I think I'm right in saying it's about £8. Now, the interesting thing is Brothers in Arms is also available as a Java game, and I think it's priced at around the £5 mark or less, depending on the market you're in. Do you think, you know, and this has happened with quite a lot of the Gameloft games as well, is this something of a problem with Engage if they're not getting the exclusive stuff, you know, when a version of the game may not be quite as good? I think in the case of Brothers in Arms, it's missing a few extra levels, and obviously there's no Engage Arena capability, although in Brothers in Arms that's limited to a high score table, which makes it pretty useless. But does that, you know, sort of impact on how this might do in the longer run?
Well, I mean, you can look at this in a Cassandra-like way, or you can look at this in an everything is fine way, similar to what Gordon Brown does. Let's start with the Cassandra one. It's, you know, it's wrong. I mean, when you can buy a game for £5, why would you spend £8 on it? Oh, you've got another level. Well, you know, these levels are pretty linear. Once you've played one, they're very similar all the way through. And this isn't the first time GameLoft have done this. They have Brain Challenge.
Yes, and the Asphalt series as well.
And they're on there. Asphalt's on there as Java and as Engage. I mean, basically, you're saying that Engage is worth 60% more than a Java version. Now, that's a tough statistic. It's also, you know, GameLoft don't really go out their way to say buy the Engage one, because let's face it, you get a 20-second demo on Brothers in Arms. The demo for what was the one, the other incredibly short one, Brain Challenge is actually quite good. It allows you to do three or four things. Asphalt is free, but Ball Breaker, I mean, just the Engage demo things, they're not showing that they're worth £8. But you can buy them for one day for £1.50, or you can buy them for a week for £4. It's not buying. You can't resell it. Admittedly, you can't do that with Java games either. But the problem is games are worth what people will pay for them. And Nokia haven't told us if people believe that these games are worth buying. They've told us more people have bought Game A over Game B, which in this case, Game A would be Creatures of the Deep and Game B would be pretty much the rest of the entire catalogue. But they've not said how many more. GameLoft will know that number. GameLoft will know how many of their titles they've sold, and I think it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next batch of games. If GameLoft start putting more effort into Engage titles, then we'll know that GameLoft consider it to be a success and a revenue-raising avenue. If GameLoft start just returning out the Java and the lower-end stuff and not add a lot more features, then I think we would have to draw a negative conclusion from that. The Engage hasn't taken off yet. I think that's the main thing. It's chicken and an egg thing. Until you have a strong, solid platform, or the belief that there will be a strong, solid platform, games companies won't do games. I'll go back to Sony PSP. When it launched, some of the first titles that came out for that, Wipeout Pure, is still one of the best-selling games, because there was the belief and confidence from the game developers that that platform would do well. There isn't that belief, I think, in the Engage platform, and as a result you're not going to see a lot of great games unless they're done by Nokia. What you're going to see is you're going to see ports, you're going to see conversions, you're going to see companies hedging their bets until they see that return, and companies will not wait 2 or 3 years for a platform to be established. Nokia probably has through to, let's be generous, February next year after the Christmas rush, and into the next financial year of 2009-2010. That's the point when games designers will decide where to spend their money and budget and development. And if Engage hasn't proven to be a good, solid business case by then we'll see a lot more of Engage's own titles.
Yeah, no, I think I'd agree with that. Yeah. And of course, I think a lot of that is another topic. We won't get into it now, but you know, Engage really needs to be shipping with devices out of the box and sort of maybe be doing more promotion there. But that's a future topic too. So, I mean, I wouldn't write it off there, but to, you know, go back to the original question, I also think you're right in saying it's about what people will pay for. You know, clearly for people who watch the mobile games market carefully and play a lot of Java games and do price comparisons, there is a problem here between £5 and £8. But I think, you know, the vast majority of people aren't ever going to see that because they're going to be downloading it on Engage as kind of the average Joe user. So I wonder whether that is, you know, it's been talked about quite a bit in the forums, in various blogs, and I think probably the problem there has been overstated, but I guess we'll wait and see there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a closed market. What you mean, and when I say closed market, you know, how many people are genuinely out there using the Engage at the moment? I mean, we know how many in-series phones are out there. We know how many are capable of downloading the client. Have we seen client download numbers come out from Nokia yet?
No, we haven't seen any metrics like that. And if you look at some of their online stuff, you know, it's still relatively small scale. Although, on the other hand, it is no sport in some of the games that have online rankings. There are now, you know, if you're at the bottom of the rank, there are, you know, in the tens of thousands of people above you. So clearly, you know, there are people playing and playing online. But I suspect it hasn't, you know, really taken off in a meaningful way yet.
My brain's just going, of course, there's tens of thousands of beta testers.
Yes, you could be cynical like that, but I mean, until they... until you actually have the engaged client shipping out of the box, you know, you can't really draw any meaningful conclusions about the engaged experiment. And, you know, Nokia have always said it's a long-term thing and they would test it gradually. And you could look upon the last, you know, 3 or 4 months. I mean, that's how long engaged has been around, as kind of a test period. And I suspect it's, you know, in these next generation of devices where it is shipping out of the box, that's when, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. You know, that's perhaps being too sympathetic towards Engage, but you know, I guess I'll give it the benefit of the doubt. But certainly I think you could give Nokia a black mark in that it hasn't performed quite as well as I would have hoped it would have done in this, you know, the first quarter of its existence. So I think that's enough on Engage, and we'll move on to another interesting piece of news that came out yesterday as we're recording that, and that's the Samsung Innovate. So would you like to briefly run us through the details of this, Ewan? As you desperately types into the background to find the news story.
How fast can we make it up? It's Samsung yet again showing their commitment to Series 60. We've already seen... did I say it wrong again?
Yes.
It's pretending to be Steve again. Yes,
just channeling him while he's not here.
You're lucky you don't have Sean Connery doing this. Yes, it's Samsung's new S64. Yes. The Innovate 8-megapixel phone camera. Steve's really the one to talk about this, I suspect, because he'll be able to go on about, you know, yes, it's a bigger sensor, but the lens is the same size, and there's lots of interpolation and edging effects and so on. But, you know, it's nice. We've seen a good range now coming out of Samsung in the 450s and the 550s and the 650s, which we've talked about previously. And this is just a good, strong, larger phone. The interesting question, as with all these things, is when are we actually going to see it on the market? And, you know, yet again, it's going for this sort of square cursor look. And I really hate the square cursor look. I hate the square cursors. We'll stop. Cursors are round things. They need to be eight-way multi-direction. And, you know, it's another phone where it's just like, why can't you do the direction control properly? And that's just from looking at the picture. I've not had it in my hand. I can't think of an S60 phone in recent past where I've actually enjoyed the cursor pad. The main interface on the phone.
So while Ewan's obsessing about the cursor pad, I'm just going to explain for the benefit of some of the listeners some of the other things we're getting with this Innovate, also known as the i8510. And I think the important thing here to appreciate is it's basically looking to compete with the sort of Nokia N96 and the Nokia N95 8GB. Ewan's already mentioned the 8-megapixel camera, and I would agree with him in that, you know, when you have a 8-megapixel camera, you really, there's a question in my mind whether it's really worth it over 5 megapixels or even indeed over a decently designed with good optic 3-megapixel camera. I'm sure that one will run. But of course, again, it's all in the marketing. Being able to say it's an 8-megapixel camera makes it more attractive to the average consumer. And Samsung have thrown in a couple of extras here. For example, you know, there's an auto panorama shot mode, and there's face and smile and blink detection to enable you to take better pictures by having clever software algorithms on board. The actual phone camera also has a lens cover, and in contrast to having to open and close it, if you start the camera application, it will open automatically, and similarly it will close when you close the camera application. I think that's a nice touch. It protects the lens. Be interesting to see how that works in practice. I should also add that I haven't yet had any hands-on time with this phone. We'll try and get hold of one as soon as possible and let you know what we think. Go ahead, Ewan.
I think the problem you might have with an 8-megapixel camera is the sheer size of the image. I mean, write speeds into memory, and specifically SD cards, is quite slow. The thing with the 5 megapixels, even on the N95, is the write time does, you know, take a time. Bang! Wait. You know, an 8-megapixel is going to be processing a lot more data. There's going to be a lot more, there's a big hit in battery life, big hit in write time to this, and that might actually make it feel quite sluggish. I leave my N95 on 3 megapixels because it's a good balance between nice good quality picture and the speed of taking the picture when I'm out with the kids visiting deserted ruined castles in the middle of the summer holidays around Edinburgh.
Yeah, no,
and an 8-megapixel camera takes a long time. Again, it comes down to how well these things work in the real world. It's all very well us, you know, frantically Googling for the style sheets and the specs and everything. But there might be something fundamentally faster in the way that it works the camera. Certainly when Samsung redid the MP3 player in the recent i450, that was quite nice with the little pretend thumb wheel at the top, and it was actually slightly faster than the regular Nokia music player. But to look at it, the specs, you just went, ugh.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, the proof is in the real world stuff, and you know, we are talking about specs. But you know, as I say, it is specs that tend to sell devices at this point. And you know, we've got the 2.8-inch QVGA screen, so that's the same as the N96. There's the integrated GPS. There's an accelerometer sensor, so we'll have automatic screen rotation. Ewan made reference to the D-pad. What that actually is an optical sensor in the middle of it, and this apparently works rather like a touchpad on laptops, in that it's a touch-sensitive control that can be used to move to move around the UI, and you know, can be used sort of in a mouse-like mode in the web browser. There's 16 gigabytes of onboard flash memory, along with micro SD card slot, so you can put another 16 gigabytes in via card. So, you know, 32 gigabytes in the phone, you know, that certainly should be sufficient for most people. You know, they've also thrown in the nice extras like a 3.5mm audio jack there, DNSE audio technology, which will apparently provide richer surround sound. We'll have to wait and see on that one. The video playback adds DivX to the usual S60 formats, and this is running the most recent version of S60, third edition, feature pack 2. Comes with a couple of embedded games, presumably as kind of a nod at the kind of Engage-like functionality. That's going to be FIFA 08 and Asphalt from EA and Gameloft respectively. And one of the things I think is particularly nice about this, it comes with a 1200 milliamp hour battery. That's basically an extra 250 milliamp hours over the N96. So I suspect the battery life will be better, and that's an all-important factor in the real world. We're told that this phone is going to be released in August for Europe, and the rest of the world will follow in September. So yes, I think this phone shows a lot of potential, and clearly there's a comparison to be drawn with the N96. It doesn't have the TV DVB-H functionality, but in other respects it's either equal or better in spec terms. But of course, you know, that's all really theoretical at this point in time. But what I do think it shows is that Samsung is right on the cutting edge with this handset. It's not really playing catch up. Arguably it is a bit of a copy of some of the previous, you know, N96, N95 type phones. But rather than being just behind them, this really is on the cutting edge. And for, you know, some people, there's some extra bits that may make it more appealing than the N96. And I really believe that this is a true competitor rather than just being an also-run. You know, it's the little things like the fact that the dimensions of this Innovator actually going to be slightly smaller than the N96. And your size, again, is an all-important thing in the real world. But I think this also underlines the commitment that Samsung is making to S60. You know, for quite a number of years, Samsung has been releasing the odd handset, but they've never really sold in any numbers. The i450 and the i550, we question whether that would happen with them, and to a certain extent it has. For example, they never got released in the UK, but I understand that they've sold quite well in some European markets where they had limited release, notably in Germany and Italy. And so I wonder whether this phone, which again ups the ante a little bit more from Samsung, might not do even better. And clearly Samsung now have a whole roadmap of these devices on the way and have committed to S60 in a fairly substantial way. You know, they're actually fulfilling their what they said at the S60 summit, when 50% of their smartphones they sold this year were going to be S60, with the implication that would be even more in going into 2009 and 2010. And given that Samsung have been, using lots of mobile platforms in a rather promiscuous way, it's interesting to see them make a, you know, more substantial commitment to S60 than they already have done. And I think that's a good thing for Nokia in terms of providing competition. And it's very healthy for S60 to have another company involved, especially given that Motorola seems to be going downhill and UIQ has an uncertain future. You know, in terms of the Symbian Foundation, Nokia and Samsung, you know, the two biggest phone manufacturers in the world, both going after these high kind of high-end, high-featured devices. it does promise a lot for the future, but I guess we'll wait and see on this one. As I say, we'll try to get it in for review as soon as possible and get some comparisons going on and give you our opinion, but I think this is certainly going to be one of the phones to watch in the second half this year. And brings me to kind of a secondary point. Actually, there's a lot of phones coming over these summer months. Some of them have already arrived, the likes of the N78 and the 6220, but there's a lot more coming. You know, the N96 now, this Samsung phone. There's some probably some more Nokias on the way. The first touchscreen device is due to get announced sometime in the near future and should be available before Christmas, certainly in the European markets. So in terms of people looking to upgrade, this is certainly an interesting time coming up ahead. And I'm getting quite a few emails saying, would you upgrade to such and such a phone? And my answer would be probably wait a little while, because there's going to be a lot more choice in a few months and the picture will clear up a bit as the manufacturers gear up for the Christmas market. And hopefully you'll also see some reviews coming along. And you know, I think this is also a foretaste of 2009, when we're going to see even more devices coming in. So look out next year for MWC, where I expect to see even more devices that push it even further beyond what we're seeing with the Innovate. And you're telling me to breathe in the back channel, so I'll just take a pause for breath and say, so Ewan, what do you think of Samsung and S60 and where they're heading?
Well, I think you've managed to cover all the bases there, which isn't surprising. What is worth pointing out, I feel, is that, you know, Samsung didn't just suddenly make this in the last couple of weeks. This has obviously been planned for some time, and it is exhibiting a roadmap. And you have to look at all these little steps together. We have budget phones, mid-range phones coming from Samsung. We have this coming at the high end. We have their investment in the developer program. Obviously, as part of that, they would have been aware of the open sourcing that it's going to becoming the Symbian Foundation and protecting us against law and order and, you know, single cars that have talking voices and stuff. Or is that Knight Rider again? Anyway, it's certainly Samsung are actually giving the confidence that Motorola never gave. And consequently, it's also the same sort of confidence that we'd like to see from Endgage coming through as well. So good for Samsung. But the two things have come up. The first one is that obviously they're aware of the whole open sourcing of Symbian, which we'll come on to in a second, I feel. But also the fact that there are a lot of phones coming out now, and people are looking to websites such as ourselves of which phone should I get. We've had a lot of debate on the site about comparing phones, especially with Steve's rather comprehensive real-world test and my slightly more, shall we say,
tongue-in-cheek.
Historic. Tongue-in-cheek. Okay, see, I was going to go for something like historic or, you know, eccentric look, but no, tongue-in-cheek, yeah. It's really hard when, you know, people go, oh, you're a Symbian site, you make Symbian win. But that doesn't matter because iPhone's better. I mean, Rafe, you have to go through all of our articles when we've written them and, you know, put that sort of editorial balance on them, and obviously we do the same in return when you review the E50. How do you deal with that? How do you compare disparate things clinically?
It's very hard to do, especially doing it in a fashion that is takes relatively, you know, doesn't use up too much time, because you can design a perfect methodology and then comes along a new device that doesn't quite fit into that or something like that. I would say, as an editor on All About Symbian, I'm always careful to try and preserve the voice of the person who's writing. You know, I have my own opinions about these things, and quite often, as you'll know, I'll put in a comment saying, I don't agree with what you said here, are you sure about that, or do you just want to clarify it? So I try not to, you know, tweak it too much, and when I'm writing my own stuff, you know, that happens equally way the other way around. People probably don't realise that there's quite a lot of back chat between the All About Symbian editors about, you know, an opinion on something or other. But certainly from an editorial point of view, you know, it's more about making sure the point that's being made is clear rather than changing the voice. But, you know, absolutely I agree with you. It is very hard to compare devices sometimes in an objective way, because ultimately what you have to do is try and divorce yourself from your own opinions and look at it from the point of view of someone else. But it's actually more tricky than that, because you don't want to look at it from the point of view of just one other person. You need to try and take a broader view as possible. And of course, it's not really possible to write a comparison article which takes into account every person's viewpoint. So inevitably, they do end up coming from one area or one point of view. And, you know, we do our best to remain objective. And It's something I'm very keen on all about Symbian, is maintaining balance as much as possible. And it, obviously we enjoy getting people's feedback, and there was some great comments in the thread. You know, it's very educational reading what other people think and what other people think is important, and obviously that plays a role in any future writing we then do. But it's also important to realise it is actually quite a difficult thing to do. So I hope people can have a certain amount of patience with us when we're trying to do these comparisons. And what I'd say, you know, when you're reading a comparison like this, and not just on All About Symbian, on any site or any review, what you really need to be doing is looking at it as a way to gain information about a particular opinion or a way of looking at it, and ultimately you still need to make your own decision. And while we'll try and, you know, provide you with an opinion rather than just, you know, going through a specification sheet, you know, what we think about a device, I'd also say, you know, you can't make a decision purely based on that. Of course it will help you, and we hope that we can, you know, educate people in that sense and give them some information to help them make the decision. But at the end of the day, you probably know yourself best, and therefore will make that decision yourself. And of course, you know, there are other factors, whether the phone's on your operator, for example, or whether you have a particular reason to want a device, you know, just because it's a nice looking device, or, you know, does your personal style come into it. We tend to focus more on the sort of functionality and how well it does something rather than some of those more intangible factors. You know, so it is, you know, a very complex decision when doing that kind of decision, what phone you buy. But, you know, we're going to keep doing these device comparisons because they do seem to be quite popular, and there's quite a few devices coming up that I think will, you know, be we'll do that for, you know, the high end in particular. You know, people still want to buy the ultimate phone, so no doubt we'll do some more of those, and maybe we'll even shock people one day by letting something else win. And, you know, it's a tricky thing, and I'm sure you can sort of underline that from your side of the fence as well, Ewan.
Yeah, I love it. We'll let somebody else win. No bias implied there at all whatsoever. It is tough because I mean, the main thing is people use their phones for different reasons. I very rarely use video on my phone. And, you know, the last thing that Stephen Rafe would want to see is a comparison of digital photography on various Symbian phones as done by me.
Because
it's, let's say, I am the David Bailey of taking pictures. Sorry, I'm the David Bellamy of taking pictures, because it's almost impossible for me to get it right.
Ewan has a very special skill at actually being able to take a picture with a perfectly good camera, hand it to someone else 5 seconds later and take the same picture, and unbelievably the quality just, I really don't know how he does it. But yes, yeah, so, you know, when I say let someone else win, you know, it is worth pointing out that we always, before starting these things, try and design them such that they are fair. I had a conversation with Steve before he started his comparison. I said, you know, oh, why don't you do something about, you know, direct printing of your pictures, you know, or getting your photos off the handset? I said, no, you know, there's no point including that one, because clearly, you know, the N95 would run away with it because of the PicBridge support and the UPnP and whatever, Bluetooth printing. And it's probably not that common a task. And equally well, we had phone calls in there. And phone calls is probably something that the N95 does better, just because it's got the physical keypad. You know, Nokia tends to be phone-centric rather than any, you know, Windows mobile phones, which tend to come data-centric in the other way. So, you know, we can see the difficulty there. And, you know, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but every now and then we'll look at it and say, you know, I can't believe the scores came out like that. But we, you know, we try to be as fair as possible. I did get some particularly nice flame emails this week telling me just how much All About Symbian sucked, and, you know, why did I even bother? So, you know, maybe to get all the trolls off our back, I need to say, yeah, let's just have a test where we say something like, if it hasn't got a touchscreen, it's not a proper high-end phone, because obviously for a high-end phone, you need a touchscreen. Anyway, I think that's enough on that. Hopefully that, you know, is somewhat educating about the thought processes that go on behind some of the All About Symbian stuff. And thank you, everybody who did comment on those. I think we'll choose our final topic of the week, Ewan, and that's, I think it's worth just looking at some of the comments that have been posted to various blogs on Symbian and open sourcing. So do you want to just summarise those quickly?
Yeah, basically, this has all come about mainly because the last week saw O'Reilly's open source conference happening in Portland, Oregon. And this is really O'Reilly's flagship conference, and it really promotes the idea, the principles, the ethos behind open source. Now, obviously, you know, open source is just something you do with your source code. And the point that many people were raising is just because the Symbian code will be open source does not necessarily mean that it will make it any better, that an ecosystem will suddenly spring up around the code just because it's given this magic label of open source. This is not a case of if you build it, they will come. You have to build it, you have to tell people, you have to make it easy for them, you have to put up signposts, you have to start working on the communities and building them up yourself. And it's nice to hear that, I have to say. There's a certain romance about open source code. You know, Firefox is always held up in bated breath because it's open source. Not because it's a very good product that does what it says in the tin and delivers to the 99.9995% of the user base that doesn't give a flying two hoots about the code that's in the background. They just want a product that works. And I think that's the same case of your phone operating system as well. Most people, when these phones are selling tens, if not hundreds of millions of units per year, just want a phone that works. Out of that, there's probably about 5% of that user base that are interested in the phone, and these are the sort of people who will go online to sites like All About Symbian and various other competitors, of the websites are available, and interact and talking and do the extra stuff. And from that 5%, maybe 1% of them will actually care to program the device and write their own applications, and from that, some of them might want to go into the operating system kernel as well. So it's a very small number. You don't need a huge number of people to actually change it. I mean, if you think Symbian's headcount of employees at the moment is between 750 and about 1,100, it's not huge. Obviously, Nokia have a lot more working in Series 60, but again, they'll be a much more diverse, much more higher level project. Actual people working in gritty ones and zeros was very small. I'm reminded when Symbian was Scion and they started programming the Series 5 that they during the day they would literally teach the programmers who had been hired the Scion way of writing the operating system, which is, you know, tight code, reuse, good memory usage, and sort of principles that have held true throughout Symbian. And in the evening, one person went through all the code that had been written by the programmers to make sure that it was doing it the proper way. And that person was David Wood, who's now the EVP at Symbian. And you have to assume that he's going to be an EVP of some description inside Nokia as well come 2009. But to get back to the point, just because it's open source doesn't mean people will use it. Jani Jalkanen, who works at Nokia, but speaking in a personal capacity, and also because he has his own open source project, DSP Wiki, which does have a strong fan base, says there's two types of people that do open source. The first is the people who love it. The second is the people who are paid to do it for a living. Symbian has a lot in number two, and very few in number one. And it's those number ones, the sort of hobby programmers, the people who build up that rich ecosystem. It's the flip side of what happens with the Nokia Internet tablets. There's a lot of hobbyists doing programs using MIMO and Linux on there, but very few people who are in third-party companies who are paid to do stuff with it. So that's open source going to the other extreme of lots of hobbyists using the open source to leverage it. Symbian at the moment, the fear is that it will be lots of people who are paid to look at it. And it, you know, it's very nice and cuddly friendly, but it doesn't actually do anything. To create that good ecosystem, you need something in the middle. You need to have that common ground. And while the Symbian Foundation strives in the next 2 years to get the code sanitized and get it out there, there's going to need to be some serious management and consideration about how you build up the community, how you get that space in the middle. Are you going to be transparent about building websites, building communities around that? Are you going to try and use a third-party website, such as yourself, Symbian, MySymbian, and ULC, to build up those communities with, you know, cold, hard cash? Are you going to try and just, you know, influence blogs by handing them out all the technology to as many developers as possible and say, program something with it and you get to keep it? Which is, you know, it all comes down to how much effort you want to put in to making these communities. Now, Nokia have already shown that they've got the business will to do something with the foundation. What that will translate to down the line, as the people that they want to attract to the platform, that also remains to be seen. It's nice that they're making these noises, and they're making them early, and they're making them loudly. We need to see action. It's all very well listening. We need to see proof. It seems to be turning into a theme today, doesn't it? Anyway, breathe.
Yes, no, I'd agree with what you have said. I mean, I particularly welcome the fact that there's this debate going on, both externally on the web, and I think it's a pretty clear sign that it's happening internally within both Symbian and Nokia. And I think, you know, there's a lot of truth to the fact, you know, if you're going to open source, you need a reason to have that happen successfully. And, you know, clearly, you know, people doing it for fun or doing it for free are part of that. Although I think it's possible sometimes to overemphasize the importance of that. And, you know, people draw obvious comparisons to something like Google Android and the enthusiasm around that, you know, and that's just not there for Symbian. I suspect part of that is because Google Android is something new, and, you know, Google are very good at sort of engaging that kind of open source community. It's one of their central things that they've done quite successfully in a number of their product areas. However, I wonder how much that newness wears off after a while, and, you know, how sustainable that is. Because I think it's a problem all of these companies are going to be facing. You know, when you're using open source within a commercial business model, you know, there probably is inevitably going to be a certain amount of reluctance around it. You know, when you look at something like, you know, Linux, you know, clearly there's a very strong community that's created this operating system. There hasn't really been the commercial drive behind it in the same way that, you know, essentially turning what was a closed commercial product into something that's open source. And, you know, there aren't very many, you know, prior stories that you can look at to see what will happen. So I think Nokia is treading new ground in that respect. And I do think they need to work on it and invest in that area. However, I would also point out within this discussion, it should be framed in the context that there are more reasons to go open source than simply to get, you know, the community and free people involved in improving the product. You know, there are going to be third-party companies looking at this sort code and improving it for their own reasons, but will then be contributing it back. And in that sense, open source is a much better model for kind of working a collaborative effort as an ecosystem to create the platform than having a closed system controlled by one company. Because if you've got access to the open source, anyone can have a look at it. And there are plenty of commercial reasons why companies might choose to improve something in particular. You know, they have their own product that's based on it, or they have a particular bone to pick, you know, with one area. So, you know, in that sense, I think we'll see development happening outside Nokia. You know, other members of the Symbian Foundation, I'm not necessarily just suggesting the big guys like Sony Ericsson or Samsung, you know, maybe some of the smaller companies, you know, perhaps someone who specializes in wireless networking stuff will, you know, do something to improve the Wi-Fi network or the Wi-Fi stack within the software because it's in their own business interest to do so. I think also you have to bear in mind that this open sourcing, I think, was partly a political thing. In order to have something like the Symbian Foundation work, you really need to have open source, because it gives a certain guarantee to the other players that despite the fact that Nokia is taking over Symbian, you know, that this is still something that's freely available that everybody can look at. And, you know, we've seen how compelling open source has become in the sort of mobile platform sense. You know, look at something like Android or look at something like Nimo, and it's the fashionable thing to do. And some of the, you know, thinking behind how it works from the business point of view and from the structure point of view has yet to be, I think, fully realized. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch this in the next couple of years, because I think we are going to see, you know, new business strategies and models appear as a result of this kind of thing. As I say, you know, we haven't really seen businesses, you know, at least in the software business like this, base so much of their central kind of, if you like, capital within this kind of open source model. And I suspect this will be very important for the future of technology as a whole to see how well this works. And I suspect, you know, if it comes off, it's going to be very successful for companies like Nokia, but also Google, who are also experimenting this area. And I suspect companies like Microsoft, which, you know, still don't like open source, you know, they play in a few areas, but essentially their model is still about having closed software. I'm going to be very worried about this and watching it very closely, because what happens with the open source on mobile platforms can equally, I think, be applied elsewhere. You know, we've seen all the problems, certainly in the enterprise world in particular, but just more generally, that Linux has had in becoming established. And the question is, can that change in the mobile world? And of course, the big difference is where Linux didn't really have a big company backer. Symbian Foundation and Android both have two very big companies behind them, and that will be a key difference in their future strategy. They're also addressing a slightly different market, and they've got different incumbents in place. You know, so yes, an area to watch with a great deal of interest, and I think it's a very interesting debate. And if you want to get involved in some of the discussion, there's spread across a number of blogs, including Nokia Conversations. We've mentioned it a couple of times on All About Symbian. David Wood is also talking about these issues on his blog, and I suspect to see more
precise.
Yes, and I expect to see more and more of this over the next few months, and it'll be very interesting to watch. And we'll try and talk to some more people about this at the Symbian Smartphone Show in October, because I think it's one of the big issues that hasn't really come that much to light. It's been talked about in back channels, but yet to see it picked up in a really big way. So yes, certainly one to watch. So I think that's probably time to finish out this week's All About Symbian Insight. As ever, we seem to have slipped over time a bit, and I hope you found something interesting to listen to this week. I'm quite well aware that people skip over to get to the interesting sections, and in the future we'll look at a way of seeing if we can do that more easily. But as I say, thanks for listening, and if you've got any feedback, please do get in touch. But without further ado, it's goodbye from me, Rafe Blanford.
Everything that Rafe said above there as well. Goodbye from me, Ewan Spence.